You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network. Other stories that you probably ought to know about. One's a huge one, by the way. The U.S. economy grew by 3.3%. Yeah, how about that? That's good. We're down to the 1%. I'm in the process of contacting liberals, okay? I've got to convince them that I get it, right? I believe in helping people, right? But if you're going to do that, where's the money come from? Look at Illinois. You can't tax it and overregulate it, or else guess what happens? They leave, and then you're really screwed. Okay, so I want to give you got to be a bit pro-business if you want all these social programs. Okay? If you want to regulate business to death, guess what happens? They go someplace else. So I want to help liberals with their platform. That's because I'm that kind of guy. Yeah, I'm a giver. Okay. So anyway, if the economy goes and we paved the way for expanding jobs, people get promoted, they get paid. It's good. So that in the news this morning. So you ought to check that out. The Associated Press. Yeah, I'm telling you, the Associated Press app for your phone. Awesome. All right, yeah, that's really the only other story I wanted to get to this morning before we listen to Colonel Fox. Now, let me just set up the interview. I don't know when the interview was done. I would think it was done in the last 5 years. I went into the data for the interview. It doesn't have a date. Has all this. It was last modified on November 22nd, which is a few days before his death. So I was looking for when this was actually done. But he talks about his time at Virginia Tech. So certainly I would say within the last couple years that this thing was done. So what this is, you're here set up, and initially the microphone doesn't really catch what the interviewers are. They're sitting off camera. He's on camera being filmed, okay? And so this is just the raw, 60-minute video, and which I prefer. Okay, so without further ado, a true Marine icon, a quality man, although he didn't like school very much, but he loved being a Marine. Colonel Wesley Fox passed away. So in order to honor him and it's just, this interview is awesome. He talks about a whole lot of stuff relative to him coming in the Marine Corps. He even talks about being a DI. He was a DI the year before the Ribbon Creek event. And he has some very interesting observations about, he didn't think Marines in Vietnam would be as good as Marines in Korea. Because the boot camp had changed, right? And you couldn't be so rough on them. Yeah, that was in the 50s. Boot camp had changed. I wonder what he would say now. Well, no, he does say it now. So you'll get his thoughts on what he sees when he goes to Vietnam, because he thought Marines would be softer. So anyway, Colonel Wesley Fox, the recipient of the Congressional Medal of Honor, the Bronze Star with the V, fought in both Korea and Vietnam, rose to the rank of Gunnery Sergeant, had been selected for First Sergeant, and then was forced commissioned, never went to OCS. He was just, one day he was a gunny, the next day he was Second Lieutenant, and then was sent to Vietnam because the Marine Corps did not have enough officers to staff the expanding presence in Vietnam. So they remedied that by selecting a group and commissioning them. So Without further ado, Wesley Fox.
Right. And you're looking at Dennis at all times?
Oh, yeah. Very nice. KC, nice. Very.
Right. This is them setting up the shot.
Okay, roll it, please, Steve. First thing we'll start with is just pronounce your full name. Yes.
Wesley Lee Fox.
Sir, let me look at what you're trying. Yes.
Wesley Lee Fox.
Sir, let me look at what your childhood, where you brought up, brothers and sisters, a little bit about the home life if you can, and hobbies and sports.
I was born on a small farm in Virginia, northern Virginia, not far, a couple miles out of Herndon, from Herndon, Virginia, and the first of 10 children. We moved after about my sixth year, we moved to a bigger farm. And I love farming. I loved everything about the work. We had horses. That was our means of plowing and all. We couldn't afford tractors. I loved horses and really intended to be a farmer. That tended to cause me to miss some of my life goals, and that I didn't like school. I didn't feel that a farmer needed all that book learning, so I didn't do well in school, and I later, of course, regretted that. But I grew up during World War II, and my cousins were all fighting that war. I was too young to go. And of course, that made me aware of the uniform and a thought of a dedication to my country for a period of time. And I guess through those young years, I really planned to do a time in uniform before getting real serious with farming, like a four-year hitch or something like that. The war ended before I was old enough to join. But the Warren County school system kind of helped move me into a military mind also, and that our days started with the Lord's Prayer, the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, and then we as a class stood, of course, stood for both of those, but we all continued to stand and sing one of our service songs. We rotated through the four each morning. And our teachers, during morning recess, would line us up online and lead us in calisthenics. And I liked that regimentation. I liked that feeling. But again, contrary to my dad's guidance and directions, I didn't feel I needed at school, so I really quit school in the eighth grade and went full-time into farming. And if it had not been for the Korean War, I probably would not have gotten away from the farm. But the Korean War started, and when I could get a break from thrashing wheat and making hay, I visited a Marine recruiter and ended up enlisting. And from there it was boot camp. I'd never known a Marine. I didn't know anything about Marine Corps boot camp other than what I'd seen on the movies, the Hollywood version of it. And I guess I could say I had an eye-opener with what Paris Island introduced me to. But I really went to Paris Island with the idea that I was going to be a Marine, and there was nothing that Corporal Reeser, my senior DI, could do to change that attitude. In the 50s, verbal and physical abuse was rampant. It's up to the DIs what he wanted to do and how he wanted to do it. But he only touched me once, and that was one August afternoon. We'd been out on a drill field for about 3 hours drilling, and we were dehydrated, hot, and wet from sweat. The Marines in those days, the Marine mentality was get tough, learn to do without water, if you can believe that. So we didn't have canteens and no water. I became aware of the fact I needed a drink, so as soon as we got back to the barracks, I intended to get one. in the past, Reeser would always follow us in. So, and I'd seen other recruits get a drink as we ran in the barracks, get a quick drink on our way to our squad bay. So I was the first one in. I hit that scuttle button, the cold water hit my lips, and I heard this voice immediately behind me say, "Shithead, I didn't tell you to drink water." And I was already moving when his boot caught me in the rear. But that was the only time he touched me. But it made a Marine out of me in 12 weeks. And then it was the Korean War, 5 months after I had enlisted. And I really met leadership there. A Corporal Davis from Pocatello, Idaho, was my squad leader. And he was a guy, I guess, that had a whole lot to do with putting my mind in battery of life in the Marines. Because he just had everything that a leader needs to lead and inspire others in tough situations like combat in a Marine rifle squad. I write a lot of in my memoirs, The Marine Rifleman, I write a lot of the little things that told me that he loved me, express how he went about letting us know that we mattered to him. He never told us that he loved us, but he just had ways of making it real obvious that we mattered to him, and that's very important in leadership. But to move on out of the Korean War quickly.
No, let's not do that. Let's spend a couple of minutes on the Korean War. Coming out of PI into Korea, there's a bonding in place, takes place within the Marine Corps. It's a place that in Korea you had to learn, or the unity of a group. Tell me a little bit about Korea and the environment and how you brought those units together.
I joined Item Company, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division. There was only one Marine Division in that war. Right after they got out of the Chosin Trap, my draft got there, the 4th draft, in January of 1951. And my squad leader kind of helped break me into the whole of what was needed and the way that life would be in the Marine Corps. And that's Corporal Davis, his way in handling us. We were short in a lot of the things that Marines today just take for granted. Like we had one canteen. We had rifles and ammo, but we didn't have things like to heat our sea rations, stoves. That was before the heat tab that the services have. That came in during my year in Korea. But what I'm really saying is a lot of days, the only meals that we had was what we could chip out of a frozen can of sea rations. Because you're in the attack, and moving in the attack, you can't build a fire. You don't have the time to build a fire and to thaw out your seas and to heat them. And then once you take your ridge lines and you set in for the night, first thing you got to do is dig your hole and clear your field of fire. And by then, it's good and dark, and you don't build a fire to do your seas, to thaw out your sea ration. So you chip that hamburgers and gravy or that corned beef hash out of your can with a bandit if you get anything at all to eat. It was tough. Of course, I was in the wintertime, and it's not all 12 months of winter there, so the summers were better. But then the summers, the problem was water. Again, we were only issued one canteen. Some of us got smart and would take canteens from casualties that were evacuated and no longer needed their canteen, so we'd carry a couple, get a couple extra that way. But it was, that war was hard for the way that it happened. We as a country were not prepared for a war. The Marine Corps was not prepared for a war. And in my opinion, the Army was prepared even less because they were on occupation duty, and that was pretty much the focus. The Marine Corps was down to only 68,000 Marines at the outbreak of the Korean War. And to get scrape a division together for what MacArthur needed at Incheon just soaked up the whole Marines from all over the Marine Corps. That's why my drill instructor at Parris Island in August was a corporal instead of a sergeant, somebody I had a little more time in. The other DI, PFC Daves, the junior, had only graduated from boot camp himself. And so we had an easy time with him because he knew what we were going through. If it hadn't, well, we could hound Corporal, we could hound PFC Days. It was Corporal Reeser that gave us all the problems. But it was a tough experience. And to take it one step further, the only training that I had on the infantry side of the house, the tactics, that kind of thing, was after we got into Vietnam, or into Korea, get my wars mixed up here. We got into Korea because the only thing we had was what we got in boot camp. And Corporal Reeser must not have been an infantryman because he didn't teach us anything on the infantry side of the house. We took our ridgelines in the Korean War in a column of files instead of deploying online or any assault formation. The hillsides, the terrain tended to
All right, you're listening to Wesley Fox, and this is an interview he did a few years ago with a project that does interviews with veterans. You're hearing him talk right now about the Korean War and his experience in Korea that will ultimately change his life.
Leadership is a very important aspect in our daily life, in civilian life. The family, of course, mom and dad are leaders, are the first leaders that we recognize. But then when you get into the military, you really see leadership at a finer level. Corporal Reeser was one kind of a leader, my DI in boot camp, because he was in a position of leadership. We did what he told us to do because we didn't want to suffer the consequences for not doing it. And, of course, I recognized that. But the bottom line is I would do things for Reeser because I didn't want to suffer the consequences for not doing it. And Davis, on the other hand, the other kind of a leader, got response from me because I wanted to do it for him. And I mentioned earlier about Davis, the ways that he impressed me with the fact that I mattered to him is just little things like frozen sea rations. At one time I heard Davis say that he was going to get a Coleman burner to heat our rations with, even if he had to carry it. Well, it wasn't that long before we went in reserve and Davis showed up with a little Coleman burner. And he loved coffee in the morning, but he didn't get his coffee until all members of his squad had finished with that stove. And little things like that, like the issuing of sea rations. Going in the attack, we like to keep our load light. Well, the sea rations came 3 meals to a box. And within those 3 meals, there'd be corned beef hash that you couldn't eat, ham and lima beans that you couldn't eat, and a couple good meals, maybe a good meal like beans and franks. We, members of the squad, would fight for a meal that you could eat when we were issued the chow, and three of us would have to split what's in that three-meal box because we're going in the attack and you're only going to carry one meal. Davis would issue out all the meals to his squad. Excuse me. Something's happening here. Can you splice that? You're going to be able to work that later?
Like that.
As I said, this is the raw interview.
But Davis would issue the meals to his fire team leaders, always with the words, "Give me the meal that's left." That guy must have liked corned beef hash because it's all he ever got. Well, I think today, if, another example is he had a 38 pistol tied load out of his hip, a personal weapon. And it belonged to a buddy of his that was killed crossing the Han River, and Davis intended to take that pistol back to the boy's father. And Davis just didn't wear it for looks. In taking the hills and clearing the bunkers, Davis would usually follow a clearing grenade in the bunker with that pistol. I was a Browning automatic rifleman, and it was my job, really, to follow the grenade in. And after becoming aware of how important Davis was to me and to the squad, I didn't like the idea of him putting himself forward like that. So I confronted him with the fact that was my job, being first in the bunker. Davis says, "Look, Fox, how much quicker I can cover an unexpected movement or an action in a corner of that bunker compared to you turning that long barrel BAR." And before I could think of a counter statement, he says, "No other hand will touch this pistol." Little things like that. But I think the biggest was on a morning in March 51, and we're moving out, moving off the ridge. It had rained all night, first rain we had after that winter. Our sleeping bags were wet. We were soaked. We'd been in the attack then for several days. Geez, maybe I better come back another day.
No, you're here now. We'll get this done. This should be the last story with Korea, then.
Yeah, okay.
Hold on. You fix this jacket again or not?
That's all right.
Okay. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. And yeah. It rained all night. Our sleeping bags were wet. We were soaked. We couldn't build a fire to eat a sea, so we were hungry, starved. We had a 50% watch every night. We were really, really exhausted. We were ready for the rear for a period of time in reserve. And we got the word to pack up, we're moving out. And that's what we thought we were doing. Going in reserve, we could get a rest, get chow, and all of the good things that you get behind the line. But instead, we were moving to the flank. And we realized that we weren't going in reserve. We were moving to take an objective that some other unit couldn't get, or to hold a hill that the hires thought would be lost. It's just going to be another fight. We were moving along, and personally, my spirits had never been lower. It was right down in the mud with my feet, and I just didn't care anymore. Other members of the squad obviously felt the same way because nobody was bitching. Nobody was complaining about it, and nothing was said. And that's a bad sign. Davis read it that way, and he obviously read it that way and did something about it. As we moved along, I heard somebody singing, "Never saw the sun shining so bright, never saw things going so right." And I couldn't believe it. Who is that ass? As I looked around and realized it's Davis. It wasn't loud. He wasn't throwing it out, being smart about it. He was just saying the words. And I had to listen closely to hear them. And then I realized he's just trying to make us feel better. I'm not going to let him do it. And I just stayed out here in the mud with my spirit. But we continued. He kept singing. And pretty soon somebody bitched. A little bit further down the trail, a respond to the bitch, and we went into bivouac and did what had to be done. Corporal Davis, the right kind of leadership, the right kind of mixture.
Career ended.
Let's hold it up, please. Don't stay. You know, sure.
War's over.
Okay.
Peacetime.
Well, maybe I need to come out of Korea with a medevac because that's key to me not going back to the farm.
Okay. All right, so pick it up. We're still in Korea.
Okay, well, of course, Davis left us, and I ended up a month or two down the road, I ended up as squad leader, but I tried to be a little Davis with handling tactics and that kind of thing. But in September of 51, I was medevaced out of Korea, and by the time I got out of Bethesda hospitals, I really wanted to go back to Crest. I was medevaced out before I was ready to leave 3rd Squad, 3rd Platoon, Item Company. And by the time I got to the hospitals, I worked to get back with letters to the Commandant. I was placed in the Armed Services Police in Washington, D.C., and time began to tick off. And I realized that I can't get back in with this enlistment. And I learned also of other things that the Marines did that I wanted to try. Like I'd heard about a med cruise where a battalion goes to the med with the Navy and hits all that great liberty. And I wanted to do that. So one thing and another caused me to put the farm off, and I reenlisted. So that kind of opened me for a 43-year tour in the Marine Corps.
Vietnam comes. When did you realize that you may have to face another enemy in another battle? How'd that come about?
Well, from the Korean War, I was a drill instructor, a recruiter, went into force reconnaissance, and while in force recon, I was with a Pathfinder team on Okinawa. Vietnam began to kick up a little action about that time, but that was 62-63 that I was in on Okinawa. That's an unaccompanied tour without your wife, family. And we, as Pathfinders, even though helicopters were committed to Da Nang, Pathfinders didn't go along. There were no ground troops allowed. So we completed our tour, came home, and I was serving in Jacksonville, Florida, when President Johnson committed ground troops into Vietnam. I realized that there was going to be probably a little action, a little conflict going on there, and my aim was to get to be involved in it, to get in a rifle company in Vietnam. So I visited my monitor at headquarters, Marine Corps, to kind of to waive my overseas control date because I wouldn't have to go because I'd just gotten back from an unaccompanied tour overseas. Turns out that the monitor was looking for the right guy to open up a new billet in shape, a Supreme Headquarters Allied Powers Europe in Paris, and for a gunnery sergeant, which was my rank at the time. And in spite of my desires, I ended up getting screwed with being assigned to Paris, France. You can believe putting it in that term. And I really thought that I'd miss the Vietnam War because it was a 3-year tour and the war would be over and I'd miss the whole thing. But luck comes along now and then. If you keep your nose clean, do the right thing, you get some breaks. Several years earlier, I realized that I wanted to commission because I liked the Marine Rifle Squad. I liked the cutting edge of the Marine Corps. That's what I was getting paid for, and I thought I was pretty good at it. And I liked the Marines. I liked the way we operate there. And as a gunnery sergeant, I was getting too much up in rank. The company gunny and the first sergeant aren't with the rifle squad. And I realized the lieutenant, I needed to be a second lieutenant and fight the rifle squads. You were back with the rifle squads. But at that stage, I didn't have the education, and I was too old already. Vietnam comes along. I'm in Paris, and headquarters Marine Corps couldn't get the lieutenants that they needed as fast as they needed them through the normal source. So headquarters Marine Corps seated a board to select 5,000 staff NCOs for temporary commission, the second lieutenant, warrant officer, and the needs of the Marine Corps. I lucked out with being one of those selected as a temporary commission. And along with that, upon being commissioned, and that's no OCS, no officer training, I was a gunnery sergeant one day, and that same day I was a second lieutenant. That terminated that duty in Paris, and next thing I know, I'm in, after a bit of time, travel and whatever, I'm in Vietnam. And my year in Vietnam, my assignment was with the Vietnamese Marines as an advisor, infantry battalion advisor. The Tet Offensive caught me halfway through that year, that tour. But basically, I was not happy with the way the Vietnamese handled the war. It was too much of what I classified as search and avoid instead of search and destroy operations. We didn't take the fight to the enemy. And in spite of my battalion doing some pretty good things, doing cleaning the enemy out of Saigon, immediately following the Tet Offensive. Again, I was not happy with, and I've got in my book, my memoirs, I talk a bit about some of those specifics. I won't get into them here, but bottom line is I extended 6 months in Vietnam to go north of our Marines because I knew they knew how to take the fight to the enemy. I was a first lieutenant by that time, and even though a Marine rifle company commander normally is a captain, I had hopes of getting a company as a first lieutenant. And as luck would have it, I did end up as a company commander of Alpha 1st Battalion 9th Marines. And that was a good experience, throughout the whole 6 months. But I think the highlight of the whole tour and Vietnam experience, of course, was my fight on 22 February 1969, in which my mission was to locate, to see if an enemy unit was where it was the day before, if it was, do something about it. Well, I found them. They were there, and I locked into them, only to find they were a bigger force than my small understrength rifle company. At that time, I was down less than 90 Marines from a 240-man rifle company. And there were several reasons for that. Like, I left my mortars on the ridge. I couldn't fire mortars in that jungle, so I didn't take them with me. But we'd taken casualties up to that point. This was Operation Dewey Canyon, and we were about 3 weeks into the operation at that point. So we'd been taking casualties along the way. But on the afternoon of the 22nd of February, as I say, I locked into the enemy force only to learn there was a bigger, stronger force than mine. I think we later determined that it was an NVA battalion that we locked into, and that's based primarily on the 105 NVA bodies that were dead in position when we finished. And to put that in comparison, I lost 11 Marines that day that were killed. I get the credit for what my company did that day. Of course, the commander is responsible for what his unit does or fails to do, so it's good that we get the positive sides also. But my Marines were the ones that really, that of course, did the fighting. And if there's any one thing that I did to ensure success that day happened prior to that. And that's really boils down to training. If not training, then at least rehearsing your plans. And what I'm talking about is several times I got the opportunity to, my company was assigned as fire base security around our combat base known as Vandegrift. And that required a rifle company to provide the perimeter security. Well, nights were the only time you had to have the whole company on the line. During the day, during daylight, 90% of your company could go to the center, eat hot chow, go to the little exchange tent and get toothpaste, beer, and drink beer, write letters home, do those kind of things, have fun. Relax, rest, sleep. Of course, you'd be on the line during the night. Well, during that time, I realized that I needed to get my Marines' minds together. An example is I'd become aware of the fact that I'd send out an ambush, and instead of them setting up an ambush the way we were taught in school, they'd go out and form a wagon wheel, a circle, all around security, but it's not an ambush in that you've got a kill zone and you've really got an effective ambush. So bottom line, what I did was seated my company on a bank, and I'm out in front of them, and taking an ambush again as an example. I bring a squad forward, talk about setting up an L-shaped ambush on a trail, where your kill zone is, where your squad leader is, your automatic weapons, your claymores, who triggers the ambush, and talk about it. Get them involved into these things and what you're going to do and how you're going to do it. And then have another squad walk into your ambush as an enemy squad. Who does what when? And then reverse that. You've got a friendly squad. Your squad walks into an enemy ambush. Who does what? How do you do it? What do you do at each point in it? And I did that with assault on fortified positions and other tactics that we needed to talk about. And what I'm really talking about, to put it in a football analogy, is we can have a bunch of players that know football, but until a coach gets them together and says, these are our plays, and Smith, you're going to do this on this thing, and Jones, you're going to do this other thing, we don't really have a winning team. I had Marines that were coming to me that had been properly trained, ready for combat from the United States, but they had never worked together in this team. We were always taking casualties, so you got your old guys are leaving and the new guys are coming in. These new guys need to pick up the feel of the way that you do things. And I was able, I probably had at least four-day training sessions of that kind of thing. So on 22 February, when I really, on that rainy, miserable, cloudy day when we couldn't use air, artillery, anything else, it was nothing but a rifleman's fight. And in that thick jungle where you can never see more than the Marine on your right and your left, the only way that we won it was because of what we did prior to. Early in that fight, I lost all my platoon leaders, killed or wounded. So the leadership was not really there, other than, of course, the platoon sergeant stepped forward and they carried the fight along with behind their platoon leaders, and after they lost their platoon leaders. But again, what I'm saying, it was each Marine's motivation to take the fight to the enemy, moving to the sounds of the enemy's guns, because no one of us could ever get influence any more than the Marine on your right and your left.
You commanded it. Right. Let's talk about you for a second. We have a well-trained platoon. But there's some things that you did during that battle. I want to know what they were. I want to know how you were able to control, to calm them down. Because bullets are flying all over. People got their heads down. They're not looking up. How were you able to control that unit from a defensive position to make them an offensive squad to win that fight?
You're listening to Colonel Wesley Fox about halfway through about a 50-minute interview that he did a few years ago, where he talks about his career, not only in the Marine Corps, but after he leaves the Marine Corps and goes to Virginia Tech. So it is, and you're hearing the interviewers. Now, the entire interview was cut up and made into about a 10-minute interview. This is the whole thing, which is way better than that little 10-minute thing. And Colonel Fox passed away last week. You're going to hear from guys who knew him. And no kidding, Marine Corps legend. More of him right now.
The fight started, I had two platoons in the assault, an assault formation moving through that jungle towards the sounds of the mortar tubes that were popping. And at that point, the enemy also had a machine gun that was firing into the trees. So we had a focal point. There was like, here we are, come get us. And we did that. Two platoons up and one in reserve. At the point where I realized that it's a bigger force than what mine was when my assault stalled. And at that point, I moved along my forward Marines in that jungle. Again, I could never see more than one or two Marines at a time. It's thick jungle, and some misty rain falling all over us, and it was really closed in. At that point, I realized it's a stronger force than mine, and what I would like to do is break contact, sorry guys, and get out of here. But each Marine that I saw was down. And unless he was firing his rifle, he appeared, I was probably impressed that he was a casualty. I thought that I was hurt worse than I was at the point where I I realized that if I want to break contact, I've got to get all my casualties out. I'm not leaving anybody. I'm going to lose more Marines doing that. And then I probably won't have enough to defend us with the carrying the wounded, and we're going to have our hands full, and we won't be able to fight. So at that point, I guess the one thing I did was made the decision that we'll win this fight. We'll either walk out or we'll all stay in the valley. And I called my reserve platoon commander up and told him to take his platoon in the attack between the center of my two attacking platoons. Normally, you wouldn't like to do that. You'd like to pull a flank movement or something of that nature. But in that thick jungle and in that foggy, rainy day, I realized that that would be next to impossible to control. So I had him go through the center of the two attacking platoons. A mortar or a rocket-propelled grenade, I'm not sure which it is, landed amongst us at about the time that he understood the order and seriously wounded that platoon commander. My company executive officer, Lieutenant Lee Heron, was standing there. He had heard what I told Jim Davis to do, and Lee wasn't hurt. So I told Lee to take the second platoon in the attack, which Lee did. And really, that's what broke the enemy's back, what Lee Heron did. Though Lee was cut down with a machine gun, died about 4 minutes after he left me going forward. So the one thing I did, was motivate my Marines and with what we do in those kind of situations when I had the opportunity to look them in the eyeballs and say, this is what we do. This is what you can expect from me that I'm going to have you do. And so it was not that any point I, Lee Hearn, Jim Davis, my other platoon commanders, Bill Christman, had an opportunity to say, follow me, and let many people see them. Again, it's in that jungle thing. If you don't have your Marines and your soldiers trained and keyed to do the right thing, and that basically, again, is to move to the sounds of the enemy's guns, you're not going to have a winning team.
Any force has two ways to go. They could go forward, they could go back. Why do you think they went forward?
Why did my Marines go forward? Because they knew that that's what I wanted them. They didn't hear anything from me to tell them to go in another direction. They knew that we were moving to the sounds of the enemy's guns, and until somebody told them something clearly differently, a Marine isn't going to lose his focus. I had some great Marines. And again, compared to my Korean War experience, we didn't know tactics. We took the hills one behind the other, one man at a time, till he became a casualty, and then was the next guy stepped up, and it was that kind of a thing. In Vietnam, even there in that dense jungle, we deployed maximum firepower forward. And to back up a bit, during my drill instructor days back in 55 and 56 as a young sergeant, I had a year on a drill field that I was God. We did things my way. What I said was what happened, and I did anything to my Marines that I wanted to do, good or bad. And unfortunately, a lot of it wasn't good for positive leadership. Sergeant McEwen drowned 6 recruits at Parris Island, South Carolina, after a year that I was on the field, in 56, as a matter of fact. And that changed everything, the way the Marines make Marines. Turned recruit depots up on their ears. Officers invaded us. They looked over our shoulders, made sure we did things the way we were supposed to do. And what I'm saying is I was convinced that Marines would never do what we've done in the past. Walk out of the Chosin, fight over the sands of Iwo Jima, those kinds of things that Marines had done in the past, because we weren't making them the way we used to. Fox was wrong. We still make Marines, and Vietnam proved that to me 11 years later on 22 February 69 and my Marines. So you don't need to belittle someone and put him down to make a man, make a Marine out of him to where he can go forward and do the positive things that warriors are supposed to do. I was really impressed by Marines that day on in the Ashaw Valley.
That medal that you wear means a lot. What does it mean to you? What does that medal mean to you?
Well, if you really back the medal down to what it means to me, I guess is purely recognition for what my company did on that day in that valley on Operation Dewey Canyon. Collectively, we did it. And along with that, what I'm saying really is I know that there were more medals of honor deserved in that fight than the one I wear. I really, I didn't do any Audie Murphy things like stand on a tank retriever and mow down a number of the enemy. And mine was more on a leadership thing and making the right decisions at the right time. But I know that I had Marines in that bush that did the actual firepower thing that eliminated the enemy and did what was really above and beyond the call of duty. And he's not recognized for it because he died in the action, and the guy that saw him, or the two guys that saw him on either side of him, either died or they were wounded seriously and medevaced out the next morning, so that there was no one to tell the story. You might know that there's a requirement that there are two eyewitnesses to attest to the action.
Okay.
There's a requirement of two eyewitnesses to attest to the action that deserving the Medal of Honor for the call of above and beyond the call of duty. And on 23 February, I had 58. Remember, I had something like 90 Marines the day before. 11 of them were dead. 58 of them were wounded that badly that because of the threat of loss of life or limb, they had to be medevaced out. So my company, I got a couple of replacements in that next day, and of course I had my mortar platoon, but I was really down a small company, and we continued to operate. We stayed in the Ashaw Valley until 15 March, still in the attack, still doing those kinds of things, so that I really didn't have the administrative time to sit down with dry paper and pencil and do the write-ups. I tried to do it as best I could out there, but there were not those witnesses around to attest to what was really done for other medals of honor. Like Leroy O'Haron, my XO, and taking that second platoon in the attack, I really intended for him to have the Medal of Honor for what he did, that I know he did, but I didn't see it. And I couldn't get any eyewitnesses to what Lee did. He died in that fight, and the Marines with him that are medevaced out, and so I couldn't get the stories. I wrote him up, but it was because of the lack of two eyewitnesses, it was downgraded to a Navy Cross.
When were you notified that you were being put into the medal?
My battalion commander, a couple of days after the fight, I was in his CP. He was on the ridge with us. My company, Alpha, and Charlie were on the ridge with the battalion command group. And I, for whatever reason, was in his CP getting some guidance of what we're going to do, I guess. And I'm on my helmet, seated on my helmet, and he tells me he's going to put me in for the Medal of Honor. Well, I almost fell off my helmet. I couldn't believe it. Turns out that Doc Hudson, my senior corpsman, had come up to him and told him all these things he saw his lieutenant do. His lieutenant did this, his lieutenant did that. So Colonel Smith got the platoon sergeants up, a few others, and got some statements. And my battalion commander wanted me to have the Medal of Honor. Well, first off, Doc Hudson wanted me to have the Medal of Honor, and he started it. And again, I'll say for then Colonel, now General Retired Smith, he tracked that medal all the way through. It's probably one of the fastest ones to go through. The action was in February. I was out of Vietnam in May. My my 6 months extension was over. In January, well, Colonel Smith, he was back in the States also, and a couple of times he'd called me to say that the medal had progressed through the different headquarters. It was out of FMF PAC, and it was out of headquarters, Marine Corps, with blessing to do it. He called me in January of 70, that's not even a year later, to say that the medal was on the President's desk. It had been approved by Congress that I would have the Medal of Honor. Well, I was an instructor at our basic school teaching lieutenants. Remember, I never even went to that school. But here all of a sudden I'm an instructor of lieutenants on tactics, company tactics. But he called me to say that I would get it. But then later, I guess a month or two later, he called me to say that who's the president? Jeez, old man. The one that got fired. Listen. He called me, I guess about a month later, after telling me that it was on the president's desk, he called me to say that President Nixon was waiting for the right political climate to award the medal. So this was January of 70, it was approved on Nixon's desk. I didn't get it until March of 71, a year and 3 months later, waiting for the right political climate. What it meant to Nixon was less living room involvement of the war. Instead of one write-up and all the stuff that goes with a guy getting the Medal of Honor, he waited until he had seven of us, six Army guys and me. And had us all at the White House at the same time to present the medal. So there's only one thing in the paper. Matter of fact, we didn't even get even the front section of the paper. That seven little pictures in the back part of the Washington Post.
What was the ceremony like?
It was a disappointment in that I had planned. Once I knew that the medal was approved and that I would get it, I really planned to get my battalion commander, Doc Hudson, all the Alpha 19 Marines in that fight that I could. I wanted to be in the White House. I at least wanted to offer them the opportunity. The guidance was only your immediate family, nobody else. So only my siblings, my mom and dad, my wife and children. My in-laws, my father, mother-in-law, very much involved in this, could not attend. The spouses of my siblings could not attend. And it was really, and it had to do with, I guess, with seven of us. If they let us bring anybody we wanted, but the White House would be snowed under. Plus, again, with Nixon's idea to keep the thing small. So it was kind of a disappointment in that way, but again, to get the medal, being a Marine at that point, I'd had 22 years in the Marine Corps, so I was pleased and proud to receive the medal for what my company did, for what we did on 22 February.
Okay, so you got the medal. What do you think the medal and you wearing it means to the country?
You're listening to an interview with Colonel Wesley Fox, who passed away last week, a Marine Corps legend, and it's pretty interesting to hear him talk about not being able to bring his comrades from Alpha 19 to the ceremony in the White House, the spouses of his siblings, how disappointed he was. It's also what's coming up is pretty interesting too. He got some instructions from the man who wrote him up for the Medal of Honor at the time, Lieutenant Colonel Smith, who was later General Smith, who's the father of General George Smith right now, serving in the Marine Corps. And he said, and you'll hear the story, but he essentially tells him, when you get this ribbon, this is the only one you wear. And he does that because, he's a good Marine. And then he talks about, in retrospect, that he didn't think that was a good idea. But it's just a fascinating look at a guy who gives you a little bit of a glimpse behind the curtain of his long, long, 43, I think, year career in the Marine Corps, a Marine Corps legend, Wesley Fox.
That's a hard one. A lot of our countrymen don't know what the Medal of Honor is, and that I guess is really not surprising. But it's like the little old lady on the school bus. So when I went home from boot camp, I caught a bus out of Washington D.C. heading out in the country toward Winchester, Virginia. And as I get on in my Marine greens, feeling real proud. This lady says, Sonny, you can have this seat here beside me. So I sat down. Again, I'm real proud. I'm a U.S. Marine as of one day. And she says, Sonny, what country are you from? This woman didn't even know her country's Marine uniform. And I realized I'd never seen a Marine in my farm area until I went to my Marine recruiter. So I didn't put her down. We moved on. I started to say something smart like I'm a Russian paratrooper. But I told her, and she was obviously embarrassed, and so we talked about farming, something we had in common. But so it's not surprising that a lot of our countrymen don't know what the Medal of Honor is, and that's one of the tasks that the Medal of Honor Society has, is making our young people aware and our countrymen aware of the what our servicemen have done, and along the way, some of the recognitions that they get. Again, I'm pleased and proud to wear it for the Marine Corps and what my Marines did on that particular fight. Again, I feel a little bit of an emptiness in knowing that there were others deserved in that fight that were not awarded. Again, because nobody was there to tell the story.
Is there anything else you would like to talk about?
No, I mentioned earlier about my decision, my thought process in putting the farm off to later down the road.
Any regrets?
No regrets. And one of the things that I wanted to do then as a young Marine in 1954 when I decided I'm going to reenlist, I want to go on a med cruise. I think I mentioned that. To the med, hit all those great Liberty ports in southern France and all those places. I retired 43 years later and I still haven't made a med cruise.
You still want to go?
No, the Marine Corps did send me over on Marine Security Guard duty, so I was stationed in Frankfurt, and I visited all the embassies from Rome north to Oslo and Moscow, west to Reykjavik, so I got a whole lot of time in that part of the country. So I don't need a med cruise. I've put up a few sailors.
I don't went to the med either. I'll tell you that story before you leave. You'll love it. Just see if you could tell me, if you can, how proud you are of being a Marine and wearing that medal. If you could put that into a phrase.
Well, let's see what you can use out of this. You can cut and paste it, right? I tell you how proud I am to wear the Marine uniform. My first 4 years as a Marine, I didn't own one stitch of spin clothes. Everything I did was in a Marine uniform. Go home on leave, working in the hay fields or whatever, I wore Marine utilities. Go in town to some movies, I wore a Marine dress, not the dress uniform, but our service uniform. And on the medal, again, that battalion commander, George Smith, on that hillside, maybe a couple of days after he told me he's putting me in for it, we had to talk about it a couple of times. I remember him telling me, when you get that medal, just wear that ribbon. You don't need all those others. Just wear that ribbon. That's all you need. That says it all. He kind of impressed me with the way he hit me with that, with the way he presented it. After I got the medal, he was the commanding officer of the basic school where I worked. And I remembered, you know, and the Marine Corps regulations state that you wear all your ribbons or your personal decorations. And you got a choice. you can't do anything other. If you wear your personal decorations, you wear all of them, all your personals. You don't just put one on. But because my commander had told me that a couple of years before, after I got it, I walked around, I just wore that blue ribbon. And I've later realized that a lot of my peers, a lot of my buddies must have thought, well, that egotistical, conceited son of a gun, and he wants everybody to know he's got the Medal of Honor. And I do feel I was wrong in doing that. And I didn't do it that long, probably a year. Well, the time I was at the basic school, a total of 2 years around there, I just wore that one ribbon. And it had to do with pride, pleased with it. But I do recognize that that's wrong. You stay with Marine Corps regulations, and like I have ever since, wear all my personal decorations. But I'm proud and pleased to meet with my Marines, and we just met last year, the Alpha 19 Marines, and that are still around, able to get together and talk about what we did. And I'm pleased to wear that and representative of what we did as a team. And I won't kid anybody. It's not for any one thing that I did. It's what we did as a team.
Oh, you're just going to do an insert of the now. So we're finished as far as the interview is. I'm just going to do this real quick. Pull back a little bit. There you go. Put your hand up and just touch the metal, if you would, for me.
All right, there you have it. That is in its entirety about an hour interview that Colonel Wesley Fox did with the Historical Division of the Library of Congress as part of a veterans project. So, yeah, how cool is that? It's just him talking about his career and how wanting to go on that med float and wanting to go back to Korea got him to reenlist, and ultimately he never does go back to the farm, and that launches him into a career in the Marine Corps and ultimately back to Vietnam from I think some kind of duty in Europe when he's a gunny and selected for first sergeant, and he's forced to move to become a second lieutenant, but that ultimately puts him in command of Alpha Company 19 in the Oshawa Valley in 1969, where they sorely needed him. I have an interesting thing that I'll read to you later. We're going to take a quick break. Chris Woodbridge is going to join us as we'll talk about what's new in the Marine Corps Gazette this month. But I listened to that, and there's another interview that we'll play either towards the end of this week or early next week about Colonel Fox that he did. And you just get, you know, a lot of it's some of the same stuff, some different stuff. But a lot of it is you get a sense of him as a guy. Grew up in rural America with rural values. And love the Marine Corps. Love the structure of the Marine Corps. And he talks about liking the structure of PE when he was in grammar school, but he didn't like school, and he left in eighth grade. So I don't know how many colonels we've ever had in the Marine Corps that didn't get very far past the eighth, didn't get to the eighth grade or got to the eighth grade, but I would say there's not too many of them. And what a cool interview, and what obviously a great piece of Marine Corps history that we lost. But, you know, again, in keeping with what we've all learned about celebrating life and not dwelling, Wesley Fox lived a great life. Married to one woman and got a great family and served his country, was the recipient of his country's highest award for valor, and we celebrate his life here on All Marine Radio. So we'll take a quick break. Chris Woodbridge joins us next as we continue here on a Wednesday edition of All Marine Radio, right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.